Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi everyone, welcome to this Charlton Live podcast. It's Louis Mendes here. We've got a packed show coming up as we discuss another baffling week at the Valley and also indulge in some addicts nostalgia. We'll hear from the South London Press Sports editor Richard Corley as he gives us the latest on the battle for control in SE7. Podcast regulars Tom and Nathan provide their takes on things, and we'll also take a stroll down memory lane as we remember a classic fixture from years gone by and delve deep into the Charlton Live archives to hear our interview with former player Johnny Robinson once more. First of our social isolating busting podcast. The whole Charlton Live team are keeping well away from each other, but thanks to the power of the WhatsApp call service, we've been able to keep in contact and bring you our thoughts on another crazy week at the Valley. Later on, we'll also transport ourselves back to 1998 to remember a classic Addicts Premier League game and listen back to our interview with the legendary Johnny Robinson. But first up on this week's pod is Richard Corley, the South London Press sports editor. He's always the man with the inside track on what's been going on behind the scenes at the Valley. And it's been another fascinating few days in SE7. Chairman, or possibly former chairman, Matt Southall and ESI majority shareholder Tanu Namir have continued their social media-based bout of handbags. The week started on Monday with social media influencer Namir posting on his Instagram that he planned to have the chairman and others removed permanently from the board via legal means and to take over the reins of the club by installing new board members that he'd chosen himself. Southall then finally broke his silence on Thursday. He'd last been seen 7 days previously being marched out of the Valley by security after a remarkable attempted coup involving staff members following orders from Namir. He now said that an ESI board meeting had taken place that afternoon and claimed that Namir had tried to install new members to the board but failed to follow due process. Southall also said he rejected any decisions made on his employment at the club as the proper procedures weren't followed. On Friday morning, Namir used official club channels to announce the departures of both Southall and Jonathan Heller from the board of directors, a role reversal from just 10 days previously when Southall claimed that Namir had resigned himself from the board. Finally, on Friday afternoon, Namir was back on Instagram to claim that Southall is the subject of a police investigation and also somewhat haphazardly claim he has provided the EFL with everything they needed, which we believe may refer to the paperwork concerning the outstanding funding source and sufficiency information required for the takeover to be ratified by the EFL and Charlton's transfer embargo to be lifted. But that remains to be seen in due course. So whilst all this was going on, the Voice of the Valley and the South London Press both reported that some of the club's former directors who hold a charge over the Valley for the £7 million in loans they put into the club some years ago are now seeking to have ESI's purchase of the club declared null and void, which would remarkably see the ownership of Charlton Athletic revert to Roland du Châtelet. It's a fascinating turn of events. So this afternoon, I caught up with SLP sports editor Richard Corley to get his take on another eventful 7 days in SE7.
Charlton Live.
So Richard, another baffling week in terms of what's going on at the Valley. I mean, what's your overall view on things? What do you think is going to happen next?
Well, I think the big question next is going to be with regard to the club's ex-directors, if people have been following this story. Obviously, it gets a little bit technical and a little bit legal, I guess, in many respects. But the bottom line, sort of, I suppose, to simplify it, is it's been reported. I've reported it. Two of the ex-directors are going to take or have started legal action in terms of sort of letters that have gone out, etc. And the plan is, as I understand it, that there would be an injunction that would be enforced, or they'd look to enforce, sort of middle of next week, really, middle to sort of just after the middle of next week. That's the kind of deadline for what they want to happen, which is essentially East Street Investments takeover to be unpicked. So you basically go back, you say, Roland de Châtelet takes the football club back on, and you're back to reset almost from that point. I don't know how much detail really to go into on that. I think essentially the ex-directors, they had a charge over the football club due to the loans they've got. If East Street Investments had come in and paid that those loans off, £7 million, of course they've got no say in matters. But I think what what's been said is that ESI's deal effectively saw Roland de Châtelet add new charges, and they are saying that is in breach of the agreement that's in place. The million-dollar question on top of all this is not only if the ex-directors are successful with what they're doing and they do unpick the deal. Obviously, we don't know what Roland de Châtelet is going to want to do next. I think one thing we know for sure is he's not going to want to have the daily running of Charlton again, and so it then opens up a fairly uncertain scenario, I would suggest.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could then end up in a situation where it's up to Roland again to move the club on to ensure he doesn't lose all that money he has in forms of loans from State Bricks to the club. So, I mean, it could put him under a bit more pressure to perhaps start looking to achieve a more realistic sale of the club?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously that's in the background, isn't it, that de Châtelet has put the loans into the club, 50-odd million, which I think in all the negotiations he's had with interested parties, you know, the 50 million debt has always been part of the actual price, or, you know, essentially what you pay for the club. The problem's been that a lot of what I call serious kind of operators who've looked at the football club, they've probably said, well, yeah, we don't dispute that you've put 50 million in, but in de Châtelet's case, that's because the club probably wasn't operating as successfully as it could have done. So I think anyone that was interested always would have the mindset, why should we essentially pay for your mistakes? And I think that's where some of the problems lie. You look at the deals that have been agreed, the Australian, well, we say it's the Australians, but the Andrew Muir one and the one that ESI did. And I think in both of those, they've probably paid over the odds in terms of what serious, credible investors were looking to do. I think probably a figure of 30, 35 was more realistic. So that's one of the problems with this. And that's the question. Does de Châtelet look at it, if he does get the football club back, and say, right, I just want to get rid of this now. I've got to accept I've got to take a fairly hefty financial hit, which he can afford to take. And then if he does, I think there are some people out there that would want to take the club forward. I think it's interesting the ex-directors have got involved at this stage. I think initially people might say, well, hang on, if the deal was in breach, effectively, why did they let it run along? I think from their viewpoint, initially, obviously, the vibe was that East Street Investments had significant money and that there was going to be investment there. So I think the ex-directors were happy to let this thing run its course for a bit, because I think initially they thought they would get their money, or they felt that ESI were a good bet. I think the fact that they've now taken measures, or at least a couple of the ex-directors have taken measures, I think it suggests that they obviously hear stuff as well, and I'm guessing they're pretty concerned at the direction that the football club is heading in.
Yeah, I mean, of course, because with the situation we were in, let's say, this time last week, and we talked about it on Charlton Live, we said, well, the happiest course of action would be if Tanoon, all of a sudden, for whatever reason he hadn't done it before, was able to prove his source and sufficiency of funding to the EFL and was able to take over the club and then run it in the way that had been talked about over the course of the last few months. Now, are you under the impression that that is unlikely, or it doesn't feel like it's happening at the moment?
I can only say, hand on heart, some of the stuff I can't always say in the public domain, but some stuff you can. Obviously, we have to be careful legally. What I would say, and it's not necessarily just a legal thing on this, but I would say, hand on heart, if you're asking me, do I think this has got a happy ending under Tanoon Demir, I've got to say that I don't. I think that if you park all the situation with Matt Southall and all the kind of stuff that's played out in the public domain, I think if you look at it without that, there will just be questions why the source and sufficiency of funding have not been agreed before all this other stuff kind of blew out there. The EFL have been speaking to me privately. They don't really comment on individual cases. They've said a few different things. And one of the things they said was that when you've passed the directors and owners test, you then have a 10-day window for source and sufficiency of funding. Now, once that didn't happen, they say then that the other sanctions come into play, which, of course, in Charlton's case, was that they couldn't spend above existing levels, essentially under a transfer embargo, although they could replace one in, one out kind of scenario. The EFL have said as well that the next AGM they have, they accept themselves that their process isn't great, because what's happened here is you've had people accepted on the directors and owners side, but of course they haven't done the other bits, but they, ESI, are still running the football club and they've still got access to the club's money, you know, the central money that has come from the EFL and also as well gate receipts, etc. Albeit now, of course, we're in this sort of unmitigated scenario where we don't know when the football's going to start again. So if you're asking me, I've gone around the houses a bit there, but if Tulum Namir's got this money, and he can do the deal, I don't know why we're not a lot quicker over the line. I think we should have been over the line earlier, even if there was issues with Matthew Southall. I know that Tulum, I think, might have mentioned on his Instagram that the documentation's gone over, but we're going to have to wait and see on that, because, as I say, I've got my doubts about it, because I think the ex-directors now, I think they've taken the game into a different scenario. We're going to find out next week how serious, how legally watertight their claim is. But if it is serious, I don't see how Tulum Namir does this unless he does everything, satisfies everything, and also pays the ex-directors out of this as well. That's a lot of money. Bearing in mind, let's not forget, he's got to complete the freeholds. Or the idea was that they would get the freeholds for the Valley and the training ground as well by June. So I've got to be honest, I think it's really unlikely that it's going to end particularly well.
And of course, the immediate future of the club is something that a lot of... it's going to be a problem for a lot of EFL clubs now, considering there are no games. But irrelevant to that, I mean, we were told by Matt Southall that the money would run out in December. I know you and I have both heard noises from people that there's possibility the money that we currently have could run out a lot sooner than that. I mean, it's clear that currently the future of the club is in a bit of jeopardy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact is that the coronavirus sort of outbreak and the spread of it and everything else and the kind of sanctions that the footballing authorities have taken, it kind of is a little bit of a distraction in one sense, in that most people say, well, actually, yeah, we might struggle a little bit financially because of the fact that we've suddenly got this major situation we're dealing with. But that doesn't change the fact that even before this kind of developed and continues to develop as a big story, that doesn't change the fact that even before that, there was an indication it was going to be December, but I think that was a figure. I think that date was just pulled out of the air by Matt Southall. I don't think everything I've heard suggested that there was a shortfall in funding and that that would be before the end of the season. And that was because there wasn't enough money in the club's accounts in terms of the EFL payments and gate receipts to cover all the expenditure. Now, that's another reason why you would say that Tulum Namir and ESI, they needed to be in, they needed to invest themselves to actually avoid this situation. What isn't so clear, of course, is that the EFL have brought forward what they call their basic award payments, and that is going to be around £800,000, I think, for a Championship side. That might potentially, I think, change the funding issue at least for a month and a half, maybe a bit more than that. But if you look at it, I don't know where that goes. That's the only thing that could change things for the coronavirus, because football clubs might, if you're already in trouble, you might be able to kind of use it a little bit as a shield. But I do go back again, I think the ex-directors thing is going to be key to this, because they could, even in this situation, even with what's going on in society, you know, at least a couple of the ex-directors there are saying, right, we need to kind of take action here. So it's going to be, I think the funding thing is a big worry. It's a big, big worry. And you only need to look at the deals that were done in Germany. I mean, the one thing that was a bit of a blessing for them is that under de Châtelet, they obviously weren't, the wage bill and the budget and the spend hadn't gone up after promotion. If it had done, when they come in January and there was bigger losses being made by the football club, or there was a loss being made by the football club, obviously it would have been much more serious.
Yeah, of course. Now, I mean, you've been talking about things there that are sort of going on under the radar, almost behind the scenes. But of course, there has been this public spat now that's been playing out for 2 weeks between Matt Southall and Tanun Namir on social media and on various club channels. They both had control of the club Twitter at one point, it seemed, in different stages. I mean, do you think this is a bit of an unnecessary distraction to what the major issues are at the club at the moment?
I think it probably is, and I think as well, I don't think it probably is. I mean, it is. Obviously, it keeps things ticking along and people talking about other things at this moment in time. I think the question I'd ask is whether this is the way that professional people operate at most football clubs. And I would say the question is, how many football clubs have you seen with individuals, I'm not just saying one individual, but individuals acting the way that they have? And I can't really think of any other clubs that are like this.
Charlton Live.
Cullen trying to take his man on. Chip ball back across. Bowers there. Pierce is there. Bowers with a header. And it's Charlton.
Yes!
Oh, it's
yes!
Oh, he's got! Oh, Patrick Barr! The absolute German beauty! Woo! Dreamland! Charlton have scored! With seconds remaining!
We've done it, Tom!
Get in! Come on! What a time to be here at Wembley! Oh my word! Oh my word!
Charlton Live.
Welcome back to Charlton Live. Many thanks to Richard Corley from the SLP for joining us on this week's pod. After I spoke to Rich, I caught up with podcast stalwarts Tom Wallin and Nathan Muller to discuss our views on the situation in SE7.
Charlton Live.
Wow, Tom and Nath, it's been a while, hasn't it? How are you guys getting on?
Yeah, not bad.
Nath, what have you been up to, mate?
Do you know what? I'm sitting in my room at the moment just looking at this same tree. I think I'm going a bit mad, but yeah. I might try and go out for a cheeky little cycle tomorrow. I don't know.
What type of tree is it?
I don't know, mate. I don't know. It's just tall and long with some things hanging like it. It's not an oak tree anyway. It's like a thin tree.
Thin tree. Palm tree?
I don't know. Am I asking? I'm not next door. Because I live on the back of my woods. It's like you've got loads of woods and then it's a golf course. So I might walk up there later and have a little investigation.
Yeah.
See if anyone knows their trees on Twitter.
Tom, have you got any trees in view?
I've got a little fir across the road.
Yeah. Is it in good health?
Yeah. Oh, it appears to be. It's growing the other side of the other houses and I can see it over the top. So, yeah. Well, that's the view from my room.
I think what I can judge from this part of the conversation so far is that you two aren't tree experts, so maybe we should turn our attention to Charlton. I mean, obviously, we've just heard there on the pod from Richard Corley. Tom, I'll say it to you. I mean, we're now in a bizarre situation where it may be beneficial to the club that we become owned by Roland du Châtelet again.
Yeah, he's going to come and save the day, isn't he? Yeah, very, very strange situation. Obviously, heard the interview with Rich and, I don't really know where it leaves us, to be honest. I think the question you asked about ideal scenario is that Tanun comes up with the cash and, you know, stands by all the statements and the words he's been giving and runs the club successfully. But as you heard Rich say, he's just not that confident that that's going to happen. So if that doesn't happen, then to me, the next best thing, which is, I can't believe I'm saying it, is that Roland comes back and takes charge. Because I think, as we said the other week, although it wasn't exactly great times under him, he at least had an element of stability and running the club on a very tight budget. Whereas at the moment, obviously, we're could be in a lot worse situation if Tanun takes over without the money behind him. So, yeah, bizarre set of circumstances.
I mean, what do you reckon, Nath? I mean, so far, Tanoon has been unable to prove his source and sufficiency. I mean, that Instagram post he sent yesterday on Friday sort of implied, he put in the comment that he has sent everything to EFL. Although, obviously, I don't think that's the proof we're after just yet. I mean, but what do you think will be the next step? Bearing in mind that these ex-directors have obviously decided this appears to be the time to make their move now.
Yeah, like you say, I mean, just looking at the whole situation, even Tanoon said that he sent the paperwork off, and I don't know if it's something to do with, I'm pretty sure it might be on that same post, whereby he was saying that it could have been a difference of sort of formatting of the banking in Egypt or Abu Dhabi or whatever. But even if that's the case, if it's just bank loans, then yeah, you can probably see he's probably liquid, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee that he's going to put that money into the club. You know, you can always have loads of money, but you still got to say to people where you get it from, how much you're going to put in, what's your plan? Because you can't, in football nowadays, you can't just shove a load of money into a club and just let it sit there. You can't just go and buy players like everyone used to. So I think that's probably, he probably has sent it, but it doesn't mean that it necessarily means it's passed and it's proved the criteria at the EFL. Well, it doesn't look like he's set much, but whatever their process is at the moment, but I don't really know. But yeah, I don't really know where it stands. I mean, from the get go, when it all kicked off with, you know, with the social media stuff, and then the things that happened like the Thursday before, you thought maybe Tanoon will get it all sorted now, and we'll see what happens. But the revelations that, like, you know, you and Tom were just saying about that, it could be possible by the time we next play that Roland's in charge is absolutely mental. I mean, because you can't imagine, right? So if we cast our minds back to January and go, right, just for the bans, right? Just in the middle of March, hang on, in the middle of March, everyone, football's going to be cancelled, right? The whole world's going to be going down coronavirus. Everyone's going to be self-isolating. We're doing a podcast in three different locations where we're in a room, and Roland's going to be in charge. The odds on that would have been pretty high.
Someone would just assume you've been staring at trees for too long, mate.
I still think I'm in some bubble, mate. Honestly, this, the whole thing has gone mad, and I think I'm resorting to trees, mate. the only natural thing I've got in this world anymore.
I mean, the way I see it is, if it does revert to Roland, if that is the case, and yet what would surely be the next step is he will then again start to look to sell the club as soon as possible, because he'll be then liable for the paying of the wages and everything like that. And he doesn't want the club to fall into administration, because if it does, his loans of £50 million, as we were saying with Richard a few minutes ago, will surely be wiped out. So whoever then comes in to buy the club wouldn't have to pay him that money, and he'll lose that money. Now, do you think this sort of situation he may find himself in, and the experience of selling the club to people who've clearly come in and offered a lot more than it's actually worth for it, do you think that will make him rethink his strategy? Do you think all of a sudden he'll now think, well, maybe it is time that I accept a lower bid? I mean, I feel like I've been saying this for 2 years running, that surely at some point he's going to realise he's not going to get that amount of money for the club. But do you think this could be fine? I mean, that's my hope. This will finally be the tipping point for him. I mean, he's not a logical man, I guess, is the answer to that. So we don't know. Tom, what do you reckon?
Yeah, that's the thing. And you say it's our hope, and it definitely is. And he's not a logical man. But you have to stand by the fact that he's not going to get this lucky twice. And Rich said it himself. He's going to have to take a look and appreciate the fact that if he doesn't manage to sell the club on, as you say, he's taking on that asset and that loss week after week after week. And we kept saying it on the show when there was rumours about how much he was losing a month. And you think, well, if you sold it now at a knock-off price, okay, you're making a bigger hit straight away. But if you're losing whatever it was, rumoured, £1 million a month, if you don't sell it for another year, that's £12 million extra that you've put into the club. So, look, if he does get it back, he's going to be fuming, because as far as he thought, he was getting rid of it and then he was going to get a sweet out in Dune, and if that doesn't work out, he's going to have to lower his price. He just has to, because I don't think he can put up with keeping it anymore. And I think one of our big fears was that he would just run the club into the ground, but as you say, that's going to affect any money he gets out of the club anyway. So yeah, for me, if it is, and there's a lot of this to the point where Rola does come back in charge, but if that is what happens, then he's just going to have to look to palm it on and pass it on as quickly as possible. And I think the only way he does that is by taking a hit and taking a lower price.
And then obviously, Nath, like we said, the ideal situation, I don't know if that's the right wording, but a potential situation is Tanoun Lemire, all of a sudden he does come up trumps. You know, I mean, Richard clearly seemed... Yeah, and he will know stuff perhaps that he hasn't put out into the public domain, but he clearly felt that that would be rather unlikely. But if that is possible, obviously he's tried to bring two members onto the board, hasn't he, this week in this explosive sounding board meeting that he had with Matt Southall. So he's clearly trying to put a form of plan in place where he wants to try and run this club. And if that doesn't get taken away from him by the ex-directors, then he has to make sure that he has some sort of business plan for the next few years whereby he's going to prove his source and sufficiency to the EFL and start running the club properly again. So for someone who, as far as we can tell, has no experience in English football, that's going to be a real uphill battle for him, you know, regardless of all the difficulties we have in the world with the virus at the moment, which will add extra challenges to it. He's going to have a real sort of uphill battle if he does eventually take control of the club.
Yeah, yes. I mean, and obviously with the news of the meeting that he had yesterday and appointing these two new bods, you know, I don't really know too much about them, but I know that they were saying that they're not there for the long haul. It's more, so I think the analogy they used was about heart surgeon or something. They're just coming in to fix it and whatever else, which is quite interesting. But however, yeah, I mean, he's got a massive task on his hands, for sure. And the thing that the problem that I have, or the worry that I have, and maybe a lot of other fans do, is we may come into a situation, especially now that the ex-directors of doing what they're doing, is that we could be in a situation where we've got probably one owner that doesn't even want to own us in Roland, and another owner that can't own us in Tanoun. So it's like, well, we're like back at square one again. So it's like, well, surely someone out there, and you know, how many times I sit here and think, if I won the lottery or become a multi-billionaire, I know I'd help out, but it's like, when like Tom said, surely at some point Roland's got to go, do you know what, I've just got to take a hit on this, because you can't keep trying to get money for people to, you know, pay for his mistakes, as it were. And but yeah, I mean, he's got a massive job, but he needs to get it done quickly. But until he gets this legal stuff done, and gets a resolution from it, you can't really move forward, because he's got two things now, dealing with the legalities with the Matt Southall situation, and now the directors, and possibly the unwinding of the ESNI deal, maybe, if that's what I read earlier. But yeah, it's mental, and it's just like, can we just have, like, come on, mate, a couple of months, or maybe 6 months, let's just have 6 months of peace and quiet, do our thing. But nah, we never do.
Yeah. So I would love it, though, if Nathan somehow became the owner of the club. You imagine the protests around his house, chopping down his trees and
throwing jam underneath your
doorstep.
only because it's you.
So this week, obviously, we've seen a few social media posts. Tanoun sort of said something on Monday, didn't he? Which there wasn't too much in it. He was talking about how it's been a difficult week and how he's working with some UK-based lawyers to finalise a process to take Matt Southall away from the club. Matt Southall then put out something on, I think, Wednesday or Thursday, saying that there had been this board meeting where he was told that himself and Jonathan Heller have been removed from the club, and that he doesn't agree with that. Basically, he's saying he doesn't think that decision should stand, and obviously it's going to be going through legal. He's also still sort of throwing mud at Nimmer's ability to run the club. And then we saw an official comment on the Charlton Twitter, which said that Matt Southall and Jonathan Heller had been removed from the board, and which we will note now is the second time in 10 days that we've had an announcement from one side of this telling us that the other side have left. So now both sides have been able to do that on the official Twitter. And then, of course, Tanoun was back on Instagram yesterday talking about how he's aware of some sort of police process going against Matt Southall. And like I say, mentioning in his comment that he sent his paperwork to the EFL. I live for the drama, you know. It's always nice to have something like this to keep an eye on. But after a while, are we not sort of thinking, Tom, that this isn't really the way that businessmen of any real stature should be acting?
I mean, yeah, I've thought that since day one, to be honest. But the last few days in particular, and I think I said it on Sunday's show, but the last few days really has brought into focus the fact that the club itself is being just left to rot, basically, while they're having this private slash public fight. And it's just, there's a running of a football club to be happening here. And the point is that the good people at the club, like Chris Parks and Tracy Leeburn and those other names we've heard, they're the people that at the moment are keeping this club alive. And that's not their job. That's not their responsibility. People like Tanoon and Southall, when he was there, they should be making sure that the club is their priority. And at the moment, they're not. They're so swept up in this fight between themselves. So my main concern, obviously, as a fan, is the club. And my worry at the moment is that the club is just falling by the wayside while they get on with this scrap. And like you, and I think we said it the other day, it would be amazing if Tanoon did come out of this and run the club properly, but we don't see that happening. And in the meantime, just the level of unprofessionalism is just unbelievable from the pair of them. And I don't think, again, I think we said it on Sunday show, nobody's coming out of this really looking particularly good. And it's just a mess. And it's unbelievable that we've gone from Roland to something that we could legitimately say is even worse.
I mean, Nath, because obviously no one's ever accused you of being a serious businessman or having any sort of level of professionalism about themselves. But I mean, even for us, it is a bit embarrassing. I mean, I was... you know, obviously, because I can't go and visit them. I was FaceTiming my nan and granddad the other day, and I was on the phone for nearly an hour, and that's purely because my granddad, who's not a Charlton fan, asked me to explain the Charlton situation. Otherwise, it would have been about 20 minutes. Like, it's absolutely baffling, and fans of other clubs now are seeing this, and they must wonder what on earth is going on at Charlton.
Oh, they do. I mean, even the most recent events, like with the statement coming out about, you know, Matt and Jonathan Heller, you know, being on the board. I mean, on Company's House, they're still showing as they're active, but you know, Tanoon said that they're not. But I don't know if is that the fits pending. It's just like I just don't think. I think, like I said, mentioned just off before we all got on the phone when you spoke to Steve Brown and on BBC London just now, he said the same thing. Just airing your dirty laundry in public, I just don't think there's any need for it. And as business people, one thing you do is if you do make some sort of press release or statement, that it's, you know, you do it and it's in a professional way. But the way the whole scenario has been handled is just mental. So I mean, even talk to like my old man about it, it's so weird. And like, I'm getting messages in WhatsApp groups from my brothers and that, going, is this real, or is this actually happening? And it's like, because it's something that we've not seen before. Well, I certainly haven't. Even at Blackpool, it weren't this bad. Well, not that I can remember it being this, like, how many TV shows can you cram into one football club like we've got at the moment. But yeah, it's mad, and it's a bit embarrassing, if I'm honest. Explaining it to people, it's embarrassing, because every time they ask you, you're like, I don't actually want to tell you, to be honest. It's actually cringy. And they'll be like, Lou, look at me, go, Nath, mate, you got to stop looking at those trees, Sam. But it's true, though. It's absolutely mental, but it is what it is, in the famous word of Beau. But I don't really know where to start. When someone says it, I'll just go, how long you got, mate? I mean, if it took you an hour, it's going to take me about 6 hours. Do you know what I mean? Cause you're a lot more eloquent than I am. So, but yeah, it's what it is, mate. But we'll wait and see for the next term, whenever that is this week, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I guess because, like, I mean, Rich is sort of hinting that we might start and find out sort of this week whether the ex-directors will be able to take this forward properly. I mean, if I was to put you on the spot, Tom, and said, is that now your preference? What would you say?
On the spot, I'd have to say yes, because I'm not confident that Tanoon with what he's doing, just based on the way he's handled everything so far. The comments and the statements and everything have been fine, but the way that they've handled this just has not been professional enough for me. So, yeah, if I was being put on the spot right now, being back with Roland, I think is probably the way it has to go. Obviously, it's not my ideal out of anything, but out of the scenarios that are currently on offer, the hope is then he would then look to pass it on and sell it on as quickly as possible, I guess.
Mm. So, and Nate, your personal preference?
It's mad, isn't it? I don't actually know, because like, if you go, I don't know, if you got missus and that, and it's like asking which next door neighbour do you want your missus to run off with, you know what I mean? I have no idea. It's because if you think, Roland, no, surely not. But then you look at Tanoon, I'm sort of trying to cling on to think, oh, this will all be sorted out. Tanoon, you know, there was a couple of admin errors, you know, as it happens, and then it's all fine. But, you know, it's taken so long now, you're thinking, is there something a bit more deeper with the bill? But, I mean, I can't even bring myself to say it, but I ain't saying his name in those words, but I'll agree with Tom, exactly what Tom said.
Yeah, and bring in Tom Dreisen as manager, I guess. right, something else I wanted to talk about away from the shambles that is our club at the moment is obviously it's now been announced that the EFL and the Premier League are going to extend this season indefinitely until we can finish it. So with that in mind, you have to, and clearly everything is up in the air at the moment with what's going to happen in our country and around the world and when we'll be ready to play football again. But if there is the possibility the next season has to be truncated, what do you think, Tom, would be the best option? I mean, there's talk of that you maybe drop a cup competition, maybe only play home and a side home or away rather than both. I mean, if you could think of a way to shorten the season, man, what do you think is dispensable for the next campaign?
Sad to say it, but I think the cups probably have to go. Definitely like the Checker trade. I know that hopefully won't affect us next season, but that can go. I think the League Cup probably can go. And if it had to, I think even the FA Cup could as well. For me, the league's the most important thing. And you want those home and away games against all the teams, because there are big teams, particularly in the Championship. And you want that away day with them. But you also want to bring them to your place and show them what you can do. You look at Leeds this season as an example. So for me, it would be making sure we still get the 46 league games and probably cut out some of the cups. Or you just try and play them as much as you can, like Bose, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Wednesday, or just try and get basically as many of them done as you can. I don't really like the idea of just playing each other once, although I think if we'd done that this season, we'd probably be in a pretty decent position. But yeah, for me, it's probably getting rid of the cups if we can.
And Nath, I want to know how you, other than looking at trees, how you're coping without football. I mean, I see the club have put up the whole of the 1998 playoff final, so I think I might sit down and give that a watch tomorrow. What else have you been doing to sort of fill the time? Because it is painful when there's no football on. It's amazing how I don't think I'd ever realise how much I look forward to just watching any game. Like, you come home on a Tuesday night and there's some random League One game on TV. I'd sit down and watch it, and now it's taken away from me. I'm like, what on earth am I supposed to do? What have you been up to?
That's what I'm struggling, mate. I'm proper am. Like, I think even if you could go down to Bromley like we've done around again, or even the Dog and Duck League, I'll go and watch that on a Saturday or whatever. That's even cancelled. So I'm resorting to Football Manager at the moment.
How you getting on?
Well, it's the 16-17 season, right? So I ain't up to date, as you can obviously tell by the date. But Charlton is the one where we got Nicky, Jose and Rojo, so I swerved that squad. I'm actually at Swindon, and I'm top after 10 games, mate.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, that's what I'm doing at the moment. I'm going to wait for the Sunderland documentary to come out, because I don't know what happens at the end of that, so I'll be interested to watch. But, yeah, I'm struggling, mate. I try and text you, not all the time, but you don't text back. You know, but, yeah, no, I'm struggling, mate. I just might go out on a cycle and that. But, yeah, it's struggling. I think the football's obviously big, but I think for me it's just missing the banter with people as well. I think that's what I'm going to struggle with, so I can't wind anyone up.
Yeah. It's strange for me, actually. My dad came round and liked to drop some bits off, but we are doing the isolation properly, so he drops the stuff off at the door. and then walks back to the end of the drive, and then we sort of talk from a distance, because that's the way you got to do it now, isn't it? So Tom, I don't know, Tom, you've been watching Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. I mean,
obviously that's quite long anyway, so that'll take up a good chunk of the coming year, but what else have you been up to?
That's pretty much the plan. We're looking for the longest box sets we can find and basically stretching them out, because there ain't much else to do, is there? So just kicking around the house, playing with the cat. That's about it, really.
Well, anyway, lads, look, it's been good to speak to you. And I might, like I say, I might take Nathan's advice and start looking out the window and see what trees there are. But I hope you guys have a good week, and maybe speak again soon.
Cheers, mate.
See you on the other side.
Charlton Live.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Great to hear from Tom and Nath on the podcast. We'll hear plenty more from those two and the other members of the Charlton Live squad over the coming weeks. Right, let's take a trip down memory lane. It's the 22nd of August, 1998. Charlton were promoted to the Premier League after that epic playoff final with Sunderland at Wembley in the summer. A 0-0 draw with Newcastle on the opening day was a solid start, but the game with Southampton at the Valley a week later would prove to be a memorable afternoon.
Away, balls for Robinson, the strike comes in, oh it's there, John Robinson claims the honour of Charlton Athletic's first goal in the FA Carling Premiership. Charlton fans have waited a long time for this moment, and it's Welsh international winger John Robinson. Hunt getting the ball in for Mendonca. Jones making the save, it'll fall for Redfern! 2-0 for Charlton. 15 seconds of the second half played, and Charlton attacking right from the start. And Neil Redfern gets what might be referred to as his just desserts. Mendonca's away here, Mendonca's in, Mendonca's over, that's a penalty, and I wonder if the goalkeeper could be in trouble. So now Mendonca up against David Howells, Mendonca steps up, it's 3-0, Clive Mendonca scores for Charlton. And here's Rufus, striding through the centre of the defence there, trying to find Mendonca, and it almost reached him, but Rufus is going to get in now. Mendonca with a chance to make it 4. Surely Mendonca, it's 4-0 to Charlton. Clive Mendonca. Well, Southampton have been routed here at the Valley this afternoon. And who would have predicted this? Charlton Athletic 4, Southampton 0. Charlton 4, and could it be 5? Oh, it could be 5. Clive Mendonca has a hat-trick, and Charlton have wrapped up their first ever top division match in London SC7 with a 5-0 victory, and Clive Mendonca, who scored a hat-trick at Wembley to get Charlton promoted, has announced his arrival in the Premiership with a hat-trick against Southampton. We'll be right back.
Charlton Live.
So it was yet another hat-trick for Clive Mendonca as the Addicts ended the day on top of the Premier League table, an unforgettable afternoon at the Valley. Now, the man who opened the scoring that day was Addicts legend John Robinson. The Welsh international made over 350 appearances for the club during his 11-year stay at the Valley. He was involved in both the first game back at the Valley in 1992 and, of course, the epic 1998 playoff final against Sunderland at Wembley. I spoke to the Addicts legend a couple of years ago for Charlton Live shortly before the dinner that celebrated the 20th anniversary of the playoff final. Let's sit back and enjoy that interview once more as John Robinson talks about that afternoon under the famous Twin Towers and first shares his memories of the momentous first game back at the Valley against Portsmouth in 1992.
Charlton Live.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it was getting back home. I think that helped for everybody to realise that they had now a home, that the uncertainty had gone and there was a vision of where the club wanted to go. And as I say, when I joined in 92, that vision was put on the wall with the stadium as what it was hopefully looked like. And so for us to progress where we did do in within 5 years and then get the opportunity to go to the Premier League was a great achievement by the club, whatever went on that day. But I think it was destiny that it fell as it did.
Mm. I mean, I think you might be the only player who played in both games, actually. So,
yeah.
I mean, can you remember what the feelings were, the difference between the pressure of playing in the first game back at the home, but comparing it to the pressure of playing at Wembley and the chance to actually get into the Premier League?
The back to the Valley dinner, the back to the Valley game was obviously that was a celebration. I mean, that was a future, all the hard work that had gone into it before I arrived in September 92, from the board, from the club, from the fans, from everybody involved, to get back was the achievement of what they wanted. And they could now feel that the club was back in their hands. So playing in that game was more of a celebration, more than anything. It really wouldn't have mattered. I mean, obviously, we never thought that, but I think to the fans, whether we lost or won or drew the game, it was irrelevant. The day was about what it was. And when, obviously, Mr. Murray opened those gates, it was a fantastic achievement from everybody involved. And I think it was just fittingly, obviously, that we ended up, obviously, winning the game, which was great. And it was a perfect ending to a perfect kind of week. But and then obviously the playoff final, that's a completely different animal. That is, you worked all year, 46 games, of which I feel is the hardest league to get out of in the world, because you have to, everyone's wanting that golden egg, which is the Premier League, the status it brings, the financial reward at the time it brought for the club, the stability and everything like that, the future. That was huge pressure. Because again, it's like anything. When you're there and you can feel it and touch it, the last thing you want to be doing is feeling that, well, I'm not going to go there after, 48, 49 games with playoffs and all that. So you knew that was pressure, and that changed people's lives and effectively the way they, where they progressed to, whether the team stayed together or not, if we didn't go up. The future of the club, maybe even Curbs staying around. So it was a big, big thing. So the pressure of both games, there was no pressure in the first game, which was more of a celebration. The second game, the playoff final, yeah, that was pressure.
And can you remember what the feeling like was in terms of going into it? Because I spoke to Mark Kinsella last week and he was saying that the club felt confident. Obviously, we'd had this amazing run towards the end of that season where we just weren't conceding goals, we were winning plenty of games. But Sunderland were the big dogs, really, weren't they? They were probably the favourites. They'd finished above us in the league. And they were, compared to Charlton, they were a huge club as well at the time.
Yeah, they were big. I mean, Sunderland's still big, but at the end of the day, Sunderland were a big club. They had obviously internationals in there, same as we did. But I think Kins is right. We went on a run. And I think the self-belief within our group that you're going into the game knowing that, you know what, you didn't just scrape in there. I think the two teams that deserve to be in there deserve to be in the final for that game. Finishing how they did, finishing with a point tally that they did, we did, all of us. So for us, I think we were quietly confident going in. But at the end of the day, as I said, it's one game.
It's you can be as confident as anything, but at the end of the day, I think we just knew as a team and as a unit that whatever happened, we would be in the game. We would always be in and around the game, and then you just need a little bit of luck to go with you as well.
And obviously, I mean, you started on the bench, so can you remember what your feelings were having to start from the bench? Was there disappointment? Can you remember how Alan Kirbishley told you?
Yeah, well, at the end of, yeah, I mean, I mean, obviously for myself, I mean, I got injured. And then I still had a cracked fibula when I was playing.
Mm.
So I came back from injury. I think I think Kerbs arranged a reserve game to see if I would get through that myself. I think some of myself and Morgs or something like that. I think it was on the week before to see whether we would be able to get through, because I hadn't trained at all for the last, I think it was maybe month or 6 weeks. And I trained just for that week, and just to see what would happen. And obviously, when I got through the reserve game, there was pain, obviously still, but not majorly pain. And obviously, Mark Kerbs had to make a decision. And I think, as much as I didn't agree with it at the time, door slammed and words were said, because I played every game, obviously, up to my injury and the whole thing. So, but. Again, I think overall it would have been it was the right decision, because there's no way I would have lasted the game. All I was pleased with, I was being involved in it, because I knew at that time we only had two subs or three subs, one with a goalkeeper and two outfield players. At that time it was 13 players, 14 players ago, it's not 18. So as long as I was involved in some capacity, that was what I wanted. And I was just pleased I was able to at least have some part to play rather than break down and couldn't get back.
Yeah, and obviously you came on quite an interesting time. We'd just fallen 3-2 behind, so we'd got back in at a 2-2. Then it seemed it was almost immediate that Niall Quinn made it 3-2 to Sunderland, and time's running out. So you're thrown on with the last throw of the game, desperately trying to find a way to get into it. So it must have been a one hell of an occasion to suddenly find yourself within as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was itching to get on a bit earlier, but I think with 20 minutes to go, I think... that's when Kerbs kind of said, okay, let's see what we got. I think that was as possibly where he felt I could, maybe 20 or 30 minutes in, last 30 minutes in the game, maybe that's where I could be fit enough to be able to go into it. As I say, only playing one game in the space of 3 months or 2 months or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it was great. I mean, when the corner went up, I don't even know if I was meant to be on corners. I can't remember. I think it was just because I was over that way. And time was, I think it was like 15 minutes to go or 10 minutes to go. About 5 minutes to go.
Yeah, it was 5 minutes to go when Roof scored.
Five minutes to go. So it was like, I think it was just because I was over that way. And all I remember doing is just make sure that I get it in the area. Don't stick it out. Just concentrate and get it into the right area, and let's hopefully someone attacks it. And obviously, I think the goalkeeper kind of got sucked into the curl a little bit, but it was a great header from Roof, obviously, when he just towered above everyone. I think that was his first goal as well.
Yeah, first ever goal.
First ever goal.
There's so many stories that come out from that day, aren't there? when you look back at it.
It's crazy.
So you get the assist, and we're into the extra 30 minutes. I mean, legs must have been tired by that point already, after the ding-dong battle we'd already had, and there was another slog and we fell behind again. But it said a lot about the never-say-die attitude that Charlton had, that they were able to come back once more. And, of course, Clive Mendonca scores that most famous Wembley goal.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we had, and that's what I've always said to people. I can't comment on other people or other teams, but when we were around for 12 years at that club, the people we had that came in every single time, it didn't matter who we brought in, the team spirit was the one thing that progressed those teams. And that came from the management, that came from the board, that came from the culture of the club, that came from the environment, everybody from the tea lady to Jimmy the physio to Mossy to everybody, and the team spirit was always going to be there. And I think that just drove us again, and it was literally like, we're not going to give up here, we are going all the way. But it was the same mentality, whether it was on a Tuesday night somewhere, it was the same mentality for us. And then, as I say, when Clark scored that fourth goal, you just felt then, you're like, okay, we've come from behind three times.
Mm.
I think it was three times, yeah, maybe three times, in the final, yeah. Player final. and you're like, okay, now could this be our day? Could this be our day? But yeah, it was an unbelievable goal, the hat trick, obviously. Yeah, and then obviously extra time was even more interesting, and then the shootout.
Yeah, I mean, what goes through your mind when you step up to take the penalty? Because I don't think I could think of anything a situation when you'd be in any more pressure, really.
Oh my god, no! It's the biggest one game in the world. It's the biggest game. People say Champions League, but you're going to be in the Champions League next season. If you finish there, you're going to be, generally the people who are in the Champions League final, generally the ones who obviously are going to be in it again the following year. Here you're not. Here you've got to slog another 46 games at that time, and you want, and everyone else is looking to get to the same thing. So you've got, it's not a given that you're going to be at Wembley again in the playoff final to get to the Premier League the following year. So it is the biggest one game in world football, from a financial component, from every component in it. It is. So to go on like, okay, well, now it's one kick. It's now down to one kick. And for me, it was all I could, I remember it. I only ever took two penalties before that. One when I was about 12, missed. And one when I went for my hat trick against Norwich at home. And missed, and Kirby laid into me because I wasn't the penalty taker.
Yeah.
And I missed that one, and he laid into me just because obviously I wasn't the penalty taker, but they gave it me because I was on a hat trick. So that was, so out of me, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's never going to get to me anyway, because I'm the first sudden death person. So there's no one in a million years, 10 people are scoring or even getting to it when it's the biggest game in the world. to scoring or whatever. So I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm like 11th person. No way in a million years. No way. So I was quite comfortable to be first sudden death person. And then just watching them go, and I'm like, oh my gosh. And it's going, and it's not like they're missing. It's quality penalties getting put up. And I remember speaking to Taff, Mark Bowen, and I'm like, got to about the third. And I'm like, on the middle of the lot, and I'm like, oh my god, this could come to me. And then it got to the fourth, and I said to him, like, what do you do? Well, he said, just don't change your mind, do it. Don't change your mind. Pick a part of the spot. And that walk, I had to have a little jog because my legs had gone. My legs had absolutely. Even now, my legs go to jelly now watching the damn thing.
Yeah.
It is crazy, because I knew if I walked all the way, it'd be too much.
Yeah.
I had to get there as quick as possible, get me head down, and I didn't even look at the goalkeeper because it was all Sunderland supporters behind him. So I just didn't look. I put the ball down, turned around, put my back to them, and when he blew the whistle, I turned and there. I'm just glad he didn't go the right way, because I think if he went the right way, he could have gone back for a cup of tea, come back and saved it.
And I think it's probably fair to say that the winning penalty that Sasa saved, I think the nerves had got to Michael Gray. It wasn't the best penalty we've ever seen, but you know, Sasa makes a save, and I just can't imagine what the delirium must have been like on the pitch to be involved in that. And there's that famous photo of everyone bundling on top of Sasa, and then everyone in the suits joins in after. I mean, can you remember exactly what was going through your mind in that dog pile?
Oh my god, yeah, me. It was who's going to get to Sasa first, me or Jonesy? And I think I got there first, just in time, because I knew that, and then all hell broke loose. It was just absolute, like, you're like, oh my god, this is where we all wanted to be. This is where the club wanted to be, and I think. And I'm not saying it's different to other clubs, but the journey of what Charlton went through, of having to leave the ground, to get back to the ground, to have stability, to get to a play, I mean, we lost in the playoff semi-finals, don't forget, before that. Do you know what I mean? So we had been through heartache as well. So we got through, we lost to the semi in the semi-finals as well before that. I think it was like the year before,
It's 2 years before, against Palace.
Palace. So we went through heartache before that. So in 5 years, what we achieved in the first 5 to 6 years of that club, and then carried on, it was anything but remarkable at times. when we got, when they say when you got the Avira going up, sorry, to the back to the valley, then you go into playoffs, losing playoffs in the semi-final, and then coming back and going to the playoffs and going through that game. And then, to be honest with you, I was so pleased when Sunderland did go up the following year, because it showed a lot of character from them. And to lose that like it is, when it's 4-4, it still now is the best game in one of the best games.
Yeah, well, there's no question about that. And so obviously the next season, I mean, we went all the way. We came so close to staying up. I mean, we'll never forget that game at Aston Villa, the 4-3 win on the penultimate weekend of the season. But, you know, even though we went down, we came back stronger. And again, I think it's fair to say that what happened at Wembley was certainly, it seemed to be the catalyst for the success that the club had over the next 5, 6, 7 years.
Oh, 100%. It was just the vision and everybody growing in one thing. And the biggest component was the management bringing in the players that had the Charlton way. Understood the Charlton way, keeping around people like myself or Steve Brown and people like that. Okay, I mean, just keeping around. I mean, when you look at it, we probably had 10 players, 9 players that would have been around for 8 years. I mean, we had testimonials. We had, how many testimonials did we have? What other club can look at that? We had coaches, we had Curbs, Gritty, Keith Peacock have testimonials. You had Brownie, you had myself, you had Richard Rufus, I think, at the time, had a testimonial. I mean, there was people who had testimonials. And then people 8 years. It's unheard of. Mm. So for us to have, as I said, they built it on and everybody had one thing. And again, when you went through everything, I mean, we went back to the valley. We lost in the playoff semi-final. We won the playoff final. We got relegated on the last game of the season. We came straight back up as champions. We finished 7th in the Premier League. Do you know what I mean? I mean, when you look at it, It's crazy how it goes.
Yeah.
The playoff final had a big part to play in where we wanted to be. It gave us a sniff of what we wanted. We knew we could live with it. We knew we had to change some stuff when we went back up there the second time. But it showed again the kind of character. It showed that Curbs, no one left anywhere. When we got relegated, I think the only person that left was Neil Redfern.
Mm.
So it showed where we want, showed everything, what we wanted to do and how we wanted to go about it. Again, no one looked to move. No one went into the gaffer's office to say, I demand a move because I want to be in the Premier League. They believed in what we were doing and believed in each other and said, well, and the pressure was a different pressure then, because everybody, the fans, everybody, the pundits told us that we were having to go up. We were automatic to go up. Why? Just because we came down. But as you know, that's not always the case.
No.
So, and again, to go up and then to go up as champions and to have that experience and doing that, I mean, I'm so privileged to have been in those kind of things where the Back to the Valley, the playoff final at Wembley, and the championship and winning the championship, and then finishing 7th, obviously, at that time in the Premier League. It's as I say, I'm just so lucky to have been involved in all of that.
Yeah, it was a brilliant time for the club. Obviously, it's slightly different times now, sadly. I mean, you're over in the States now, but you still keep an eye on how the Addicts are getting on, especially, of course. Under one of your former teammates now, Lee Bowyer.
Yeah, I think it's the right appointment. I think Bo knows the biggest thing. He knows the history. Again, Charlton is so unique. You have to understand the history. You have to understand what it means and everything like that. And again, Bo gets it. It was hard because last year he didn't know if he'd be getting the job full time for this season or not. He went into this season all the way up to that, not really knowing still. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
So it's not people look at, okay, what's happening now? What's happening then? But it's a preparation before. So I think the only thing could have happened a little bit is if they said at the end of last year, hey, you're 100% in, do the announcement, bang, finished. He can then know, he can go and get maybe the players he's looking for, go and look, there's other, do you know what I mean? Whole set up his stuff, set everything in the foundation, set everything up for the beginning of the season, for pre-season. But when there's still an uncertainty, you can't, if you're talking to a player, you can't turn around and say to him, well, I'm definitely going to be here, because he hasn't signed a contract at that point.
Yeah, it certainly makes it a lot more.
It makes it hard. Yeah, it makes it hard. People look at pre-season or the beginning of the season, but things for coaches and managers, they prepare well in advance.
Of course,
who they want to try and get.
Stability was the thing we had under Alan Kerbsey as well, of course.
100%. Exactly. Mr. Murray or the board didn't sack Kerbs. They gave him a new contract when we went down.
Seems crazy this day and age, isn't it?
But that's what I'm about.
Yeah.
This is what I'm on about. You didn't see the players demanding to leave. So it's the same here. It needs stability. It needs to say, you know what, this is it. It takes time to sort itself out, as I said, because Bo did, as I say, was during the preseason, I think, that you got eventually the confirmation that you're definitely doing it full time or whatever. But he's the right person. And he's young, obviously. He's got the history. He's got great experience. So why just not say, you know what, you've got it?
So,
and he's progressing right. I mean, he's won, what, 4 or 5 on the bounce in the league?
Yep, 4, yeah.
4 on the bounce. So, I mean, that's not an easy achievement at all in any league. So, obviously not pleased of obviously going out of the FA Cup, but the same thing is, I mean, he's quite honest as well, Bo. He played with his heart on his sleeve, and what he's the same thing. He's like, okay, that wasn't maybe my first priority. Wasn't the FA Cup. If we can go up, then that's a priority. And times have changed a little bit from when we were playing. Players are quite comfortable being rested. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're not. Like, we'd be smashing down club. Bo, myself, Scotty Party, everybody would be smashing down closed doors if we were rested.
Yeah.
If we were dropped, we could handle drops, but don't not rested. I mean, that's what we're there to do. And the games are now even, as I say, it's different now. So I think, but again, you have to change with certain things and have to look at it differently. Bo's won four league games on the bounce, and they're going in the right direction at the moment.
Excellent. And just finally, I wanted to ask, of course, this week about another one of your former teammates, Darren Pitchell, sadly passed away last weekend. He also played in that Back to the Valley game, scored the winner, of course, at Ewood Park in the FA Cup. He was well loved by Charlton fans, and such a sad loss to see him go.
I couldn't believe it. Again, you share so many memories and times that people don't see behind on the training ground, on the coaches going up, and in the changing rooms. And I remember, as I say, Darren obviously welcomed me when I came to Back to the Valley, back up to West Ham, and then went there. He was a no-nonsense kind of midfield, at the time fullback, then he got into midfield. And at times, sometimes not as rated as what we rated him as, because we knew what he brought. But a genuine, fantastic fella. I was really obviously disappointed and upset when I heard about it. It wasn't a good feeling because, again, the camaraderie that we had and how many people helped me get settled in at Charlton and give me the reason why I wanted to stay for 12 years was people like Darren Pitcher, Tommy Cate, and people, all those people when I arrived there. Bob Boulders, I mean, so for me, Pitch was one of those people. So I'd be sorely missed, that's for sure. And at such a young age.
Charlton Live.
Right, that's it. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Charlton Live podcast. Thank you to Richard Corley, to Tom Wallin, Nathan Miller, and of course John Robinson for joining us on this week's episode. I've been Louis Mendez. Thanks for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it. We shall see you back here next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.